Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Honorable Supreme Court of Ohio is now in open session pursuant to adjournment.
Good morning, be seated, please. The first case on our calendar is 99-1876, Robert Overland versus Akron General Medical Center. Ms. Davis.
Yes, sir. May it please the court, my name is Rhonda Davis, and I, along with William Zavarillo in Akron, Ohio, represent Bob and Eva Overland, the plaintiffs in this matter, the appellants to this court. In December of 1994, Mr. Overland, who is a plumbing inspector, a master plumber, and an avid golfer, underwent a procedure on his left thumb. And during that procedure, the physician, Dr. Hill, had placed a pneumatic tourniquet similar to a large mechanical cuff above his elbow, and the purpose of that is so that there is a bloodless field for the operation on the thumb. You're supposed to leave that on 1 to 1.5 hours. Unfortunately, in this case, Dr. Hill was running behind, and he had left it on Mr. Overland's arm for 2 hours and 24 minutes. And a complication of that surgery was that he had damaged the left ulnar nerve. And the left ulnar nerve services the pinky and the middle of, starting in the middle of the ring finger on the left hand. And it continued up his arm. And the injury is called reflex sympathetic dystrophy. It means it's a short circuiting of the nerve in the arm. His treating neurologist came and testified that that was the cause of the injury. There was an anesthesiologist who also testified about the pain management and the other issues relating to the surgery. Thank you. Yes, Your Honor, the issue that's before the court, as you know, is that Dr. Vrabeck, the sole expert in this matter, had a previous or had a pending medical malpractice action in Canada. Remarkably, it was a very similar procedure involving the same type of tourniquet, involving the same injury to the same nerve.
Is that all the similarity between the Canadian and the plaintiff's injury here? Is that key to your proposition of law?
Yes, it is.
Since it is, the fact that the trial court seems to have made its decision by saying it did not have enough information when presented with the problem at trial about excluding that evidence, the trial court's problem was that it did not have the important factor that you're emphasizing here. And then the Court of Appeals didn't have that Canadian. And then the deposition of the Canadian physician is not part of the record on appeal. Is that harmful to the, even if the proposition of law is good, is that harmful in this case?
No, I don't think so. Because if you look at the deposition transcript from the videotape,
counsel, if it's not part of the record, why would we look at that?
If I can explain. The deposition transcript of Dr. Vrabeck has set forth, as I put forth in my brief, I went through the different similarities. And so it talks about it was a surgery on the left arm, damage to the left ulnar nerve, reflex sympathetic dystrophy, Kazalgia is what it's called in Canada, but, and he admitted that those were the same problems, the same issues. And if I can follow up, Your Honor, with what you just said, I found that in this case, there are similar types of problems that are encountered by different medical malpractice plaintiffs. That PIE, the insurance company which insured Dr. Hill, and Jacobson, Manor, Tushman, and Kaler found experts by looking to see who had been sued on medical malpractice matters so that they were now more familiar with these types of procedures and the ones that were subject to the medical malpractice of the plaintiffs. And that's how often they matched up who the experts were.
Is this something in the record, or this is?
No, this is actually a part of the reason that the Ohio Academy of Trial Lawyers has become involved in writing the amicus brief. And just remarkably, in Judge Cosgrove's room in Akron, identical situation just happened within the last 6 months to an attorney named Michael Monteleone in Cleveland. But if I can go back to the issue about the proposition, please. It is very important that in the cross-examination, which is the most crucial attack for the plaintiff on the defendant's expert, that you be able to provide evidence to the jury of bias, prejudice, and motive to misrepresent.
Would it be generally true that the doctor had other malpractice cases not related to this type of thing?
Although there are some state courts, Supreme Courts, and a federal court that have held that, I think that the better proposition, to be more fair to the defendant and the defendant's expert, would be to limit it like it's been done in Connecticut and in Maine, so that it would be on the same or similar issue. That way you have less confusion for the jury. I think that there's a closer nexus.
Only instances of similar.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is hand enough?
I'm sorry?
How similar?
I think that it should be broken down to similar procedure, similar injury. I mean, this is really a textbook example of how you should apply this case if you use those. You know, we considered that when we drafted the proposition of law. And one of the concerns about that is that the defendant needs an opportunity to explain, we believe. The defendant's expert needs an opportunity to explain what happened as a result of the medical malpractice actions. And although someone can be sued multiple times, often you're going to find that there will be there'll be a wide variation. It could span decades for someone. There are more problems and more, I think there's more room for confusion for the jury. And I think really, in order to be fair to both sides, I think you have to limit it to similar procedures.
I'm having a little trouble getting past why this simply isn't a discretionary issue for the trial judge.
Yes, she did. She had it actually in her file.
Any deposition or trial transcript or anything from the malpractice case in
Campin versus Vrabeck? Your Honor, actually, that's the interesting part about this. She did. She had it in her court file. I hand-delivered it to the judge. I did not file it. She asked for it immediately the next morning, and
did not file it, so it's not part of the record.
That's correct.
So that's not part of the record. So when I look at the transcript from the trial judge reviewing the evidence before it, the trial judge finds it involves the ulnar nerve, and there's a complaint of pain. And the witness has no recollection of any other similarities. That's about the extent of what the trial judge had. And the trial judge says, that's not enough for me to admit it. Why should we be second-guessing the trial judge? Why should we be reversing we're not a court of error, we're basically looking for proposition law. This seems to be simply a discretionary issue. What proposition of law are you saying that we should adopt based on the evidence in this case?
Your Honor, I would like to, you have really basically three questions. Number one, I think you have to understand the context in which this decision was made. This was a very, very difficult case. Not because of the facts, but because of the conduct of the counsel on the other side. And there were numerous... I'm not at liberty to go through everything because I have limited time, and I really would like to reserve a couple of minutes for rebuttal. And the other factor that the court is not aware of is that Judge Cosgrove, 2 weeks later, had a pacemaker inserted. She was very, very tired. She was very withdrawn. It was very difficult to get to her. And this information did. It came really, I guess, at a very bad time. She was very angry at both sides.
And she said she gave it to you. At the end of the day, it didn't give her time to get it and research it. And yeah, I see what she did.
And if I can, let me explain a little bit more about that. The deposition was taken on Friday because the defendant would not make his expert available. It was videotaped on Friday. They hand-delivered it to me at 3 o'clock in the afternoon on Tuesday. And excuse me, 3 o'clock on Monday. I, of course, being in trial, didn't have an opportunity to review it until that night. I put forth my all my information, and I prepared my additional objections, which she had discussed with us prior to trial, that was permissible, and then I presented those in a timely manner. Now, what should happen when you have questions like that is that the trial judge should take the time to review the objections so that they can make a fair determination on the issues, and unfortunately, that did not happen. I wish I could put that in as well, but I do believe that I think in every case a trial judge has the opportunity to exercise the best judgment by taking time to review all the issues, as painful as they may have been.
611B. How would you phrase that you were to write the syllabus? It says, cross-examination shall be committed on all relevant matters and matters affecting credibility. How would you write the syllabus in this case? And what's your attempt to do?
I would use the proposition of law that has been drafted. I think that is so closely tailored. It goes along with 616, and this case is an example of bias, prejudice, and motive to misrepresent. So I would use the proposition that we had set forth.
Second sentence would be the real law that you want. The first sentence is pretty much.
Yes.
Sure.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is the real.
Yes, Your Honor. If I can, I'd like to just talk briefly about the fact that this is really a very short extension into the area which has been carved out by the Ohio Supreme Court and some other areas which pertain to financial interest. Don't think for 1 minute that there wasn't a financial interest aspect to Dr. Vrabeck's testimony. He had to testify the exact same way that he had testified in Canada, where he had just come from. And this Supreme Court has, as far back as 1884, been very concerned about bias and prejudice issues, but Calderon versus Sharkey, Eady versus Atrium Healthcare, and Davis versus Immediate Healthcare all have addressed that those issues are probative of the matters affecting financial interest and bias and prejudice. And if you would also look in our the information that we've provided, Your Honor, there are several courts that do agree with our position, including the Supreme Court of Maine and Connecticut have closely tailored their proposition, their law, to be similar actions or in similar medical malpractice cases.
Thank you. don't know that specifically that has anything to do with 611 and 616, but as I was moving my way through these briefs, I wondered about the time delay and the time that the medical malpractice issue arose in Canada to be finally discovered.
Oh, that... I did. I took one 2.5 weeks earlier because that Jacobson, Maynard, Tushman, and Kaler would not provide a proper opinion letter. I got a one-line opinion letter that said Dr. Hill had committed no negligence. I had to go back to the court. The court instructed them to provide a more detailed letter. And then the court said, well, while you're at it, why don't you give your experts? So after we got...
So long to discover the issue.
I asked him in the medical malpractice expert discovery deposition. Is it one of my usual questions? I ask medical malpractice. And you know, he really didn't know that much about what had gone on in Canada. He was very vague, and as soon as I got back, I contacted almost every attorney in Lethbridge, Canada, where he had just come from, and I found the firm that had defended him, and I found the firm that had represented him, and within about a week, Your Honor, I had gotten the deposition, and that's when I was aware of it.
But you didn't, you never made that deposition part of the record.
No, no, and if
I... How can you review it? I mean, all we have is what you submitted is a vague description of Canada, but that's all the trial judge has to do by. We don't have an in-depth deposition that we can judge what.
But, Your Honor, in order to impeach a witness, you don't have to have a deposition. You can ask it in the questioning of the witness. And that's what I chose to do. Well, Your Honor, I thought that I made my record by asking the questions. And that's the way I chose to do that. Are there any additional questions?
Thank you, Ms. Davis.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is John McLandich. I represent North Hill Orthopedics and Dr. Hill in this matter. And our office has taken this matter over after the liquidation of PIE. You know, the differences between the plaintiff and defendants in terms of propositional law is a relatively small one in this case. Plaintiff talks about making this sort of impeachment admissible if there's a similar medical malpractice action involving a similar injury. Our proposition of law seeks to vest such impeachment issues in the discretion of the trial court where we think it properly belongs. And in our view, it's apparent even from plaintiff's proposition of law that discretion will continue to be vested in the trial court with respect to, at a minimum, under plaintiff's version of the events, this issue of a similar injury and similar medical malpractice action. I disagree with it, perhaps not in total, but in part. I think that the court, the trial courts, do need direction from the court as to what exactly the boundaries of probative impeachment is when you talk about this particular issue and the issue of whether a pending or prior medical malpractice action against a defense expert or a plaintiff's expert, for that matter, is always probative. I would say that there's probably, you know, like so many things, some minimal level of probativeness from any mere allegation of malpractice or negligence on the part of the expert. But the problem that I have, frankly, with this case is I've prepared for it is where do you draw those boundaries? And it seems to me to be an inappropriate boundary to simply draw it at the mere fact that an allegation has ever been made or is pending, because as all of us know that are involved in the court system in defending these kinds of cases, allegations are made sometimes properly, sometimes frivolously, and to allow the mere throwing up of the allegation to be the scope of the impeachment or the basis of the impeachment seems to me to be terribly problematic.
Well, are you contending the fact that this case that it hadn't been established in the record that this case was pending in Canada?
No, I think that it was established that the case was pending, but I guess from my perspective on this record, I don't think there was a sufficient showing put forward to allow this impeachment in this case, because
611B doesn't use the word probative. It says relevant matters, and it uses the word shall. Cross-examination shall be permitted on all relevant matters. Don't you think that's a relevant matter, that the fact that he had a similar case pending in Canada?
Well, I think that, and I'm sorry I couldn't recite to you the rule by number, but I think that relevant evidence is always balanced off against its prejudicial nature in deciding whether to admit it or exclude it. And I think that the mere pendency of an action is insufficient or is sufficiently prejudicial versus its probative value to not be admissible without a greater showing, at a minimum, that it's similar injury, similar procedure at a minimum, and frankly, I think there should be more than that required. From my perspective, I think what should be required is, you know, there's plenty of avenues provided in the civil rules for impeaching someone with respect to prior conduct that's inconsistent or prior statements that are inconsistent, and if this person's been the defendant in prior medical malpractice actions where they've engaged in a similar type procedure alleged to result in a similar injury from their negligence, now they can be impeached with both their conduct as demonstrated and with their deposition testimony or trial testimony in that other action to the extent that it shows that now what they're either saying or doing in this action or saying was properly done in this action by this doctor was in fact not proper. The problem I have is, and I think what you'll see that what the plaintiff put in the record was, I just want to tar him with the mere fact that a claim's been filed against him. And well, I don't really think you can, in the sense that I think if you're going to allow those kinds of impeachments to come in, then you have to allow the defendant expert to put on a sufficient showing to demonstrate, here's what was really involved with that case, here's really why what I did, here's why it was either proper or improper, to allow the jury to form the opinion as to whether the events in the prior case would or wouldn't affect the opinion that they'd be giving in the present case. Because otherwise, you're back to this business of, you know, let me tar him with the mere allegation, and then not let him put on the underlying merits of that event so that people can form an impression as to whether or not it does or doesn't create some pecuniary interest or bias or passion or prejudice. You know, this business about inconsistent testimony, I mean, if the testimony's, you know, inconsistent, they can certainly be impeached with their deposition. That's
the other side of the participant, because you have, you always hear about, particularly, I guess, the allegations against plaintiff's attorneys, they go out of town, out of state, hire experts, and bring in hired guns. And those of us who have tried cases recognize that both sides do that. If you were defending a medical malpractice case, and if the plaintiff's expert were brought in from some faraway place, the plaintiff's expert, like them, had pending a similar case, would you want to cross-examine on that?
I probably would, and it seems to me that the business that they should be allowed to cross-examine with respect to isn't, to me, it seems, proper to simply try and impeach them with the fact that a claim's been filed. It seems to me if you really want to impeach somebody on those kinds of issues, you have to get into the underlying conduct that they engaged in to demonstrate either their conduct was proper or improper and either consistent or inconsistent with the standard of care and or the position they're taking in this case, because now you're impeaching them with something that someone can grab onto and that has substance, as opposed to just, you know, it's the when did you stop beating your wife kind of impeachment otherwise. Well, I don't.
Let's cross-examination go. That's where you could establish. It could be established whether or not it was simply an allegation or whether there was substance to it.
Well, and I don't disagree, and I think that's where it comes down to the discretion of the trial court in deciding whether to admit it or not admit it, and the level of showing that needs to be made to establish your entitlement to engage in that sort of impeachment. And I don't think it's enough to simply say to the witness, have you ever been sued? Do you have a pending action? You know, maybe that's a threshold inquiry that needs to be made, but I don't think that's sufficient to get it into the record at the trial at which this person's now an expert. I think that if you want to get it into the record, you've got to establish what conduct did they engage in, what's the standard of care, and is it inconsistent with the standard of care, and now are they trying to sort of cover up their own breach of that standard of care by saying, well, no, this guy got it right because he did the same thing that I did.
Absolutely. It sounds like are you putting forth the argument that here, because with the trial court was charged with weighing the probative value balanced against the potential for unfair prejudice, because any time, you know, another malpractice case, I mean, maybe any impeachment is prejudicial, but we're just to measure unfair prejudice. Is it your position that this case is an error case at worst, and that no new rule need be put in place because the balancing usually works? I mean, the plaintiff here is suggesting this case presents a good case for a per se rule. That any, and actually counsel has limited that to say where there is an action, you know, any cross-examination on a similar action, a similar injury, per se, doesn't need balancing. Take the trial judge out of it, because the trial judge, maybe in this case, you know, the problem is in this case, when we have a trial judge who erred for whatever reason, you know, they're not machined. So we've got, do we need a new rule? Because in this case, maybe the trial judge didn't understand the probative value here, and didn't properly assess it, or, you know, was tired or...
No, I think that I frankly don't think there was an error committed. I don't really think we need a new rule of law. I think the rule of law in the Calderon versus Sharkey is still good law, in the sense that it's within the discretion of the trial court to allow the admission or exclusion of any evidence, including impeachment evidence. And the question is, when or shouldn't it be allowed?
Counsel's point is, in which case would the trial judge would the trial judge properly exclude cross-examination of an expert, in this case, any expert in a medical malpractice case where the questioning is about a similar, you know, malpractice case with similar injury, similar procedure?
Yeah. Well, in part it goes to two things. The first thing it seems to me to go to is the showing that's required to establish your entitlement to engage in the impeachment. And I think that the trial judge, and sort of going to my prior answer, I think the trial judge in this case properly weighed what was before the trial judge. I don't think it was, frankly, a product of fatigue or what have you. Well, I will. Well, yes, in large measure, because what you have here is a situation. Here's what the trial judge had. She had the deposition of the medical expert in the pending case, and the questions that counsel sought to ask, which were, you know, do you have a pending action, you know, and what were the allegations, and so on and so on. Now, the doctor's recollection of that, as the courts recognized, was somewhat limited. He recognizes, yeah, she's complaining of pain, you know, it was on the hand, involved a tourniquet, whatever. Now, as was pointed out again in the record, and as the trial judge discussed, there was an insufficient demonstration to her that it was the same procedure, involved the same injury, notwithstanding that the plaintiff's alleging it's the same procedure and the same injury. And I guess my point is, under the abuse of discretion standard, it's not enough to simply put forth the allegation and say, let me impeach him with respect to the fact that there's a matter pending. It's the trial court's discretion, which is the standard. Obviously, the trial court has to exercise its discretion in deciding, do we have a similar action, do we have a similar procedure, do we have a similar injury, and, you know, given now the record that's put before me, when I balance those things in terms of deciding how similar it is, and therefore what impeachment it's going to engender, is that going to be enough to entitle it to come in versus trying to tar someone with the mere fact that an allegation's pending. And my point is, in this case, the showing wasn't sufficient.
You tried to tar someone.
Yes, ma'am.
You've taken over this case in the ministry, but you've had an opportunity to learn all about it. I assume you learned the details of what actually happened in Canada or what's alleged to have happened in Canada.
You know, I've confined my analysis to the record.
So you just don't ask, don't tell
was
sort of your policy
when you're looking at it. Well, when I handle an appeal, my policy is to confine myself to the record because those are the events I know the court can look at, okay, so it seems to me that's the relevant evidence.
Okay, the inquiry about this, the doctor admittedly vague answers, and we don't know whether that's selective amnesia or whether he truly doesn't.
That's correct. We don't know.
If you're on the other side, you're confronted with, I can't go anywhere with cross-examination because it just says I don't remember the details. You pitch that to the judge. I mean, at least the questions were asked flesh out something that appeared on the surface to be a similar kind of injury.
Well, it seems to me if you want to take the
did it appear to be a similar kind of injury and the answers to
it appears to be a similar type of allegation.
And then there is at least the statement that the judge was, did I understand correctly, pitched, it wasn't filed, but the judge was pitched a copy of the...
You know, that's the
representation from...
That's the representation made here today. Frankly, it's the first time I've heard that representation. All I know, again, is I can find myself to the record because that's the evidence that's relevant to the litigation.
Just on the record, it would be
yes,
your
sir.
Conclusion, this, under the rule, this is not admissible.
Yes, because an insufficient showing has been made to demonstrate that it's proper impeachment. Yes, sir. That's absolutely my position.
And it's insufficient because of what? Why is it insufficient?
Well, because all that's really been put in the record is the fact that allegations are pending.
I didn't know the answer to the pertinent question.
Well, and she could certainly have impeached him with the deposition, even at his deposition, to say, look, I have your Canadian deposition here. In the Canadian deposition, you say, yeah, you did use a tourniquet. Yes, it was a fusion of the less distal radial whatever, and it did cause reflex sympathetic dystrophy, and you did leave the tourniquet on too long. And so what you're saying this doctor did is the same thing that you did, and now you're trying to cover up for him. And, you know, if that had been done at deposition, perhaps the court would have had a record to allow them to engage in the sort of balancing that they need to engage in under an abuse of discretion standard, even under the plaintiff's scenario, to make the determination, do we have similar injury, do we have similar conduct by the expert that's underlying his opinion in this action. And that's why I said I think the difference in terms of the proposition of law, you know, the plaintiff at first was very per se, and recognizing the difficulty of having a per se rule, has now backed off to the point where now we're saying, geez, it's similar action, similar injury, so forth and so on. Well, this is just the abuse of discretion standard, now with a little bit of meat put on the bones in terms of, here's what I think the court should consider in exercising its discretion. I think if it is a sufficient demonstration made, and they think, frankly, a sufficient demonstration's made, if they say to the person, well, isn't it true, doctor, that you were sued for an action in Canada where you engaged in the same conduct or were involved sympathetic dystrophy damage to the nerve and that's enough. And I'm here to say I don't think that's enough. I think you have to demonstrate that, in fact, the underlying merits are sufficiently similar to outweigh the prejudicial effect that will happen when you bring in this extraneous information from the outside, because otherwise, I think you have a scenario where it just becomes terribly unwieldy, and it's going to generate a real free-for-all, quite frankly. And I see my time is up. Unless the court has questions, I would ask that the court affirm. Thank you, Your Honors.
Thank you, Mr. Davis,
Your Honor, I'd just like to sum up and tell you that This does not have to be a rule which results in a full-fledged investigation into the medical malpractice action of the defendant. It is enough that it is raised, and the defendant's lawyer can ask the questions to rehabilitate this expert, just as you do with other impeachment. And the words unfair prejudice were used in this case. Well, in this case, the unfair prejudice occurred to my clients because the jury was deprived of information which would help them in making a decision about credibility of the only expert that sided with the defendant. Yes, Your Honor, his deposition sat in front of me. He saw it. He saw me reading off of it. And he still answered the same way.
Opposing counsel has raised the fact that apparently he could have gotten this to a point where he feels it would be admissible if you just asked some more detailed questions from the other deposition.
No. Well, Your Honor, I did summarize the deposition with my questions. I did not have to say, in your deposition, it says, in the deposition. As a matter of fact, I guess I did ask one question about...
But you didn't enter it into the record at any point, either through that deposition or through the trial judge. In other words, as I thought, the trial judge didn't have the benefit of what you knew, and your witness didn't come forth. Even though you were trying to use that depo, he wasn't giving you the information that you wanted, that you now need on appeal, and it was all there.
But, Your Honor, I go back to my response to Justice Stratton's question, which was on the issue of whether or not the deposition is needed. For proper impeachment, you do not have to have a copy of the deposition. You can impeach by questions. And if I can...
But it was a proffering that needed to be done to support on appeal that there was an abuse of discretion.
And, Your Honor, I go back to the morning that we had this discussion. There were books thrown around the room by opposing counsel. This was a very erratic hearing, and there was no opportunity that was given. If you see the long discussion from the trial bench as to whether or not the information was going to be gone into, The plaintiff did not have an opportunity to go into further information about that deposition and to talk about more detail. It was very difficult. Thank
you.
Justice Pfeiffer, am I fine?
I have a question.
Yes.
How strongly would you argue to us that we should not be involved, adopt your proposition of law,
you're saying how would I feel if you guys adopted the proposition, but still held that we had not met our burden? Well, I would think that would be inconsistent with the proposition in light of the answers that I've given today about the similarity and the threshold.
You argue that for a per se application of the law?
It is per se. I think it's sort of a hybrid, if we can explain it that way. There has to be a limit, we believe, in order to be fair to the defendant or any party, actually. This will happen to both sides. This is going to be an issue for both. And that is, if the judge finds that there is a similar medical malpractice action, similar injury, similar procedure, if that threshold is met, then that information comes in, and the plaintiff should be, or the defendant should be able to inquire about that and bring it to the jury's attention. So I think that's how it should operate.
Thank you.
Thank you.